Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Minorities in Tennis Show here at the UR Tennis Network, the show where I have the privilege of chatting with minorities involved in this great sport of ours. My name is Alex Chan, and I'll be your host for today. When I'm not hosting this show, I am a staff member working at USTA. I actually work in the Mid-Atlantic section now as a Maryland Tennis Service Representative. I am responsible for developing and supporting the growth of tennis throughout the state of Maryland, which is also my home state. For more information about USTA Mid-Atlantic section, you can visit midatlantic.usta.com. And for more information about USTA Maryland, you can visit maryland.usta.com. Before I introduce my special guest for today, I would like to take a moment to play some words from our sponsors.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At ussportcamps.com, you can plan out a Nike tennis camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit ussportcamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike tennis camp at www.ussportcamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike tennis camps and take your game to the next level.
And welcome back. Again, this is your host, Alex Chan, and you're currently listening to the Minorities in Tennis Show on the UR Tennis Network. Listeners are more than welcome to call in to ask the guest questions during the broadcast by calling in at 714-583-6853. Again, that's 714-583-6853. Please stay on the line until I'm able to get you live on the air later in the show. Well, for today, my special guest will be Lange Johnson. He is the grandson of Dr. Robert Walter Johnson, the person most responsible for molding and developing the careers of Althea Gibson and Arthur Ashe. He was the leader of the original diversity push within the sport by breaking barriers for his changes on a local, sectional, national, and international level. Lange is also a current member of the USTA Virginia's Diversity and Inclusion Committee. Everyone, I would like to welcome Lange to the show. Lange?
Hey, Alex, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for coming. Those that are listening out there that may not know who you are just yet, can you kind of go ahead and give a brief introduction of yourself?
Sure. My name is Lance Johnson. I'm a native Washingtonian who's been involved with the sport of tennis for over 45 years. My family's been involved with the sport for over six decades. And as you said, my grandfather, Dr. Robert Walter Johnson, was largely responsible for the first diversity push within the sport, really trying to break the color line by getting the best and brightest athletes across the African-American community to hone their skills together in sort of a precursor to the IMG academies and the voluntary academies of the current day back in the 40s and 50s. So when I'm not playing tennis, I'm the vice president of operations at Time Life, entertainment company responsible for product sourcing through distribution. So very active in the sport still, and you know, as a player who played in a lot of national junior events as well as Division One college tennis, you know, I've recently come back to the sport in the last 5 to 7 years, and I have to tell you, it's so much more enjoyable than I remember. You know, I'm having more fun now than I ever did, and that's the great thing about tennis. It's a sport that gives throughout one's life, and you can play it for many years, and that's a great thing.
Yeah, definitely. So like you said, your family line was very influenced by tennis. So I was going to ask you, like, how did you get started with tennis? Did you kind of start out with a racket in your hand once you were born?
Yeah, I mean, you know, tennis for me started out a lot like school did. I remember, you know, I'm one of five siblings in my family, and I remember all the older siblings going off to school every day before I was in kindergarten, and I always wanted to be part of that. And, you know, they would take off every morning, and I would, you know, turn to my mother a lot of times probably crying because I wanted to get involved, and tennis was the same way. My siblings got a little bit of a head start on me. We would spend summers in Lynchburg, Virginia, where my grandfather lived, but my first memories of tennis were on the backyard clay court that my grandfather built to manage the junior development program that he was involved in with the ATA. So the earliest memories are working with older siblings, dragging the ball machine out to the court and playing with a sawed-off racket my grandfather had made for me after ordering it stocked from Wilson. So it wasn't too heavy. So I had a little sawed-off racket and a lot of tennis ball. I remember spending a lot of time out in the backyard hitting balls around, or at least trying to hit balls around with my older siblings, and working out with the ball machine.
Oh, great. Wow. So you use a sawed-off racket. I thought that's done. Like nowadays when you see the new under tennis format, are you a little bit jealous that now these kids have these shorter rackets?
Yeah, you know, it's the new technology has actually paved the way nicely. These kids don't realize we used to play rackets that we would drag around behind us before, you know, the appropriate size of equipment was developed by all the manufacturers. But that was the way it was, you know, and one of the reasons the two-handed backhand developed so quickly was because the weight of the rackets with juniors holding them, they were too heavy. So a lot of juniors had to put a second hand on the racket in order to control it. And therein lies the development of that shot.
Yeah, I'm not surprised by that. All right, so like you said, you grew up, you're playing tennis with your siblings, and then you said you went to some official like junior programs after that, like the USTA.
Yeah, so once we got up and running and started, I started at 5 years old, and my father, Robert Walter Johnson Jr., essentially ran the camps for my grandfather out of Lynchburg in the summer. So during the days, he would be providing all the training and support. So naturally, having a father who was a teaching pro allowed me to develop pretty rapidly. So between 5 and 12 years old, I spent a lot of time trying to understand the fundamentals of the game, and having my dad at the table every night talking about grip and footwork and position at the net and how to handle a return of serve was so beneficial. So by the time I was 12, I was, you know, making some serious inroads in national junior events. I got to the quarters of the Sugar Bowl in 12 and unders, and I also got to the semis of the St. Louis Invitational, where I played Ken Flack in the semifinals. He had gone 38 matches without the loss of a set, and I ended up going out there and winning the first set in 105-degree heat. Got tuckered out in the third set. He came back and caught me in the third set. But those were the kind of, you know, we would get in the car on the weekend, load everybody up, and go off to the sectional and national events and compete pretty much throughout the country.
Oh, wow. I imagine that kind of got pretty expensive, right, if you had to travel all the time for these competitions?
Yeah, but my grandfather, as a physician, and who was extremely passionate about the sport, would underwrite all of it. Basically, we would have, you know, anywhere from 10 to 12 kids living in Lynchburg through the summers. A large portion of those kids would be living in my grandfather's home, and he would underwrite everything: food, tennis balls, entry, rackets. I mean, anything you needed. His goal was to make sure that once we stepped onto the court, you didn't need to worry about anything except playing the best tennis you could. So no one was worried about whether or not they had a place to stay at the event or if they could afford the entry fee. That was all taken care of. What you had to give in return was 100% effort, and you had to obviously conduct yourself in a way that was commensurate with the best sportsmanship out there. He would not allow folks to show a lot of emotion. There was no racket throwing or cursing or anything like that in his camp. If you did that, you were sure to be gone shortly thereafter.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I blame him for doing that, for all that he does for the kids. That's great. And I guess another thing, I have a question too, that you obviously tennis has been a big part of your life since you were young, very young. Have you ever kind of gotten sick of tennis over time? Like, did you feel like you're like, what had tennis pushed on you, or did you just kind of enjoy it because it was a just great opportunity?
I think for me, the thing that I got the most enjoyment out of was the competition. Definitely there were other sports that I played growing up that I also enjoyed. I can't say that I loved them more, but there were definitely sports that I played that I really got a lot of enjoyment out, one of which was football. The other was I played a lot of soccer. But the unique thing about tennis is it's an individual sport, and if you can thrive in a competitive environment like that, you really will hold your own. And so that was the big thing for me. I think another thing was, you know, tennis came pretty easy. I had a lot of instruction. So, you know, very early age, I had all the strokes and knowledge that I needed to go out and compete very well. And so as a result, I think I probably didn't appreciate it as much as I do now. And that's one of the things that, you know, getting a little older will do, give you a little time to reflect on how important things in your past have been. And so now it's, I'm right there. I'm drinking the Kool-Aid. I completely love the sport and want to do anything I can to help others come to the sport, particularly kids who are not in the position to be able to, you know, play at the best clubs or with the best competition and, you know, learn from the best coaches that are out there.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's great. So, I mean, yeah, so obviously you're a big supporter of tennis. So currently, what are some things that you're doing for sport tennis right now?
Well, you mentioned it earlier. I'm part of the Diversity and Inclusion Committee with the USTA Virginia section. And, you know, the principal reason for getting involved there was basically the family history. My grandfather took it upon himself to do what he could to change the history of the sport. And that is very near and dear to my family. And so my ability to get involved in the committee and to provide input and you know, help out and deliver whatever I can to the community that's underserved with tennis, I think I'm all in for that. One of the other things that I'm focused on right now is also setting up a 501c3 in my grandfather's memory, and the goal there is to create tennis and education programs for underserved youths, much like he did in his lifetime, and help kids figure out a way to get to college through the sport of tennis. Part of the foundation will be focused on restoring and preserving his home and the tennis court where, during his lifetime, five Wimbledon champions played on that tennis court. So the goal would be to make sure that we save that important history. It's on the National Historic Register. Places already, but the goal is to really, you know, further that by restoring the property and making sure that we create the appropriate museum and legacy that he definitely deserves.
Oh, great. That sounds amazing. It's a 501c3. I'm guessing it may also eventually become a NJTL as well with the USTA.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea is that whether or not we're able to recreate what he was doing in Lynchburg in the 50s and 60s, there are a number of centers of excellence across the country. Katrina Adams, who's a friend of the family, has a nonprofit in Harlem focused on tennis and education and helping kids who would otherwise not have a chance to play the sport to really take advantage. And so whether we centralize that at Lynchburg or raise money to fund programs that are already in place is yet to be determined. But that's some of the things that we'll have to wrestle with and grapple with as the foundation evolves going forward.
Gotcha. Well, I wish you good luck on that. And for those that are listening, again, if you'd like to speak with the guest or me during the show, you can call in at 714-583-6853. Again, that's 714-583-6853. All right, let's actually talk a little more about your grandfather, Dr. Robert Walter Johnson. As we mentioned, he's a pioneer in tennis. But can you kind of actually talk a little more actually about how he kind of got started, his legacy with tennis?
Sure. I mean, he was an athlete in college, and he played halfback at Lincoln University. So he was a pretty formidable guy in terms of his athletic ability. And once he left college, she realized that he needed some kind of outlet to de-stress. You know, he was going to medical school and doing his residency, and he stumbled onto the sport. And, you know, just by happenstance, he fell in love. And beyond that, once he fell in love with the sport, you know, he spent a lot of time participating in the ATA, the American Tennis Association, outings. And this was basically the African-American equivalent of the USTA. So these were all African-Americans, not exclusively African-American, because there were a lot of folks who were not African-American who would actually play the events. I mean, we were developing players at a very high caliber. And so there were white participants in the ATA Nationals as well as African-American. So this was sort of the precursor to integrated tennis. And so at some point he just got the notion that, hey, this doesn't really seem to make a lot of sense. It should be the best players, regardless of color, competing against one another, and we need to figure out how to get involved in some of the events that had previously been white only. So he was in Charlottesville ostensibly for some medical training at the University of Virginia, and while he was there, they were hosting the National Interscholastic High School Tennis Tournament, and he sat there for a couple of hours and watched these kids battling it out on the courts there. And, you know, after 2 hours, he got out of his car and managed to find the tournament director and said, hey, listen, what would it take for you all to allow one or two of my charges to participate in this event? And that's how it started. The tournament director said, come on back next year and bring two guys. We'll give you two slots. So he took the best two guys he had at that point and brought them back, and they absolutely got slaughtered. I mean, you know, I'm not sure either one of them won a game, but that was the beginning of a continual process of integrating the sport. So pretty soon, two, three years later, the people he was bringing to participate in the event ended up getting deeper and deeper in the draw until finally I think Arthur Ashe won the Interscholastics. Don't remember the year, but I think he won it. I think his late as 64. I could be wrong on that. So that's kind of how it started. And then the genesis from there was I need to identify at least one person who's got the ability with my training and support who can break the color line on the world stage. And that was Althea. She did that in 1950, playing in the U.S. Open, or the U.S. Nationals, as it was referred to at that time.
Okay,
and,
gotcha.
And
cool.
Arthur,
I was going to say, you also got a chance to meet Althea Gibson and Arthur Ashe as well?
Yeah, in my younger days, Arthur would be playing the tour events in the D.C. area and would invariably call the house to see if I was available to warm him up. So that's one of the neater things I got to do was warm him up for matches. And in the process, you know, when you're warming up Ash, and what happens at some of these tournaments, there's only one practice court. So I would end up playing with Bob Lutz and Stan Smith and Tom Gorman. And, you know, I've played with McEnroe in 78. They were both playing doubles in D.C. at the Volvo tennis tournament. And I ended up playing with John as well. So it was one of the nicer treats of having those relationships and continuing them into my teenage years.
Yeah, that sounds like a great perk, actually. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right. So I want to talk a little more about the American Tennis Association. I just did a quick a look up about it. It's based in Largo, Maryland. So it's in my neck of the woods. Do you have any involvement with the American Tennis Association now?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I have not played any of the ATA events for a while. They host a national tournament every year, which is a really big deal in the African American community. And my brother and I were thinking within the last couple of years that we really should go back and play a doubles event just for kicks. I won the 12 and under ATA Nationals when it was hosted in D.C. many years ago. I won't tell you what year because it will divulge my age, but it's an amazing event. Actually, we've been trying to more involved with the organization. We've spent some time with the new president of the ATA, and he's very very focused on transforming the reputation of the organization. It's kind of suffered a little bit over the last decade or so, but I believe it's in good hands now. And I think, you know, going forward, Alex, we'll probably establish some more tighter connections given the work we're trying to do on the 501c3. I think there's definitely a place at the table for the ATA as it relates to that history, because they're very much a part of that legacy. And Althea Gibson played the ATA championships many, many times. And in fact, she played mixed doubles with my grandfather and probably won the event six times. Now, bear in mind, Althea carried him every time. I'm not sure he would have told us that way, but so there's a very, very rich history there with a lot of phenomenal players. And, you know, no one who's anyone of color has gotten through the gauntlet without playing that tournament and being involved in that tournament. So it's a very important association, and I am hopeful that it too will return to its former glory.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I was reading a little bit about it just now. It says it's one of the oldest African American sport organizations in the United States. So that's a great legacy. And let me know in the future if you need help getting in contact with them or working out some kind of involvement with them with your 501c3, since they're in Maryland. I'm covering Maryland now, so I'd love to help you out.
Great.
With that. Okay, and then just kind of going back to Althea Gibson and Arthur Ashe. I obviously, your grandfather was a big part of their development. Can you kind of describe what were the type of things that he kind of did with them to help improve their game?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, you know, my grandfather's program or platform was very similar to, Balotelli's platform, which was bringing the best kids across the country together to work out and in the process, drive each other to higher heights. And so Althea and Arthur both spent about 9 summers in Lynchburg, Virginia, honing their skills. So basically it was, you know, Althea's the best and brightest. Let's put her to the battery of players. I mean, she would play guys as often or maybe more often than she played ladies growing up, because my grandfather was making her the best that she could be and knew that in order to beat the women at the top of the game, she had to be able to take down a lot of guys in the process. So that was part of the mix. And so it was a very disciplined environment from, you know, during the winters. Althea spent time in Wilmington, North Carolina, at one of my grandfather's colleague's homes to finish high school. She spent her summers in Lynchburg, and when she wasn't, you know, they played and practiced 5 days during the week in Lynchburg, and then on the weekend everybody was loaded up into Chevys and Oldsmobiles and driven off to these tournaments across the country. Some of them were ATA events, some of them were not. I remember it vividly. By the time I turned 11, we were caravanning for most of the summer. Greensboro, Knoxville, I mean, you name it. Mm-hmm. The cars would roll out on Friday, and they wouldn't show back up until Sunday evening. And that's the way it was all the time. I mean, sun up to sunrise, it was all about tennis. And when it wasn't tennis, it was discipline.
Mm-hmm.
Discipline. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. Cool. And then did you also talk about Arthur Ashe as well? Like, was that?
Yeah.
How did he work with Arthur Ashe?
He was the same way. There was a point in Ashe's early time at my grandfather's home where my father was providing instruction, and Arthur had come down from Richmond, Virginia, and Arthur probably was 11 or 12 at the time. And my father was trying to teach something that was one of the staples of our program. And Arthur, I don't remember exactly what it was, but Arthur kept saying that Mr. Charity, his former teacher in Richmond, Virginia, didn't teach it that way. He taught it another way. And so he was having a hard time migrating to the new process. Well, my grandfather came home, and my father gave him the download. My grandfather got on the phone with Arthur's dad, and within, you know, a couple hours, his dad was at my grandfather's back door. And Arthur's dad pulled him aside and said, listen, you're with Dr. Johnson now in his program. What Ron Charity said doesn't mean anything. You need to either listen to what they say, or I'm going to have to take you home tonight. And that was the last time my father or grandfather had any trouble out of Arthur. I mean, from that point forward, he was all about taking direction and what we thought was the best thing to get him to the top. And sure enough, you know, several years later, he was at the top of the game.
Wow, that's awesome. Great. You spent a lot of time with your grandfather. Do you have any, like, what's the happiest memory that you've had that you worked with him in the past?
Well, I mean, Alex, it was pretty amazing. I was probably 11 when he passed away, but I do remember vividly when he would walk into a room, and you know, I remember it, you know, every night when he would come home from rounds at the hospital and, you know, seeing patients at his office, and he'd want the rundown on what happened that day. And let me tell you, man, I don't know if you've ever seen the E.F. Hutton commercials, but when he spoke, everybody completely, I mean, he was larger than life, and everybody completely listened attentively. And it was pretty amazing. And you know, he did not say a lot, but when he spoke, you knew there was something of essence that was coming from him. So it was pretty amazing. He was just an incredible leader, visionary. And, you know, the fact that he was willing to spend so much of his own hard-earned money to you know, get kids from across the country to the top of the game, and ultimately, in a number of cases, college educations and better. You know, have to salute him completely. Yeah.
Definitely. So I guess it wouldn't be a stretch for me to say that he was probably one of your most influential role models in your life, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, whether you get the stuff directly or through osmosis, I think there's a lot of things that I observed in his behavior that I think were critical. There's a right way and a wrong way to do things, and he always was trying to do the right thing in order, you know, understand the rules. And he'd always say you've got to understand the game before you start playing. So that was his deal. And you know, he was a believer in anything can be done if you put your mind and effort to it. So he got it done.
Good. Yeah, and it sounds like he's a very respected figure in the tennis history. And I know that he was entered into the International Tennis Hall of Fame for the class of 2009. And I was watching a YouTube video yesterday of you, and you were the one that did a speech about him during that introduction. So how did that feel when you did that?
Well, you know, it was an incredible feeling, and I can't take complete credit for the speech because my older brother Julian and I not only worked on the speech for a while, but we worked for 3 years to get him in. He ended up on the ballot in 2006 and missed going in by 2% of the vote. So we spent time with the hall personnel to make sure that he ended up on the ballot in 2007. Well, When that didn't happen, we were obviously disappointed. So we had to step up our process and ended up having some intense conversations in 2008. And you know, we were fortunate enough. I mean, listen, you know, so many times in Arthur Ashe's and Althea Gibson's lives, they both said, you know, they couldn't have done it without my granddad. So the thing we tried to impress upon the hall was if both Arthur and Althea, who were in the Hall of Fame at that point, knew that they couldn't have reached the heights they did without my grandfather. Why doesn't the Hall of Fame understand that yet? And, you know, we got it done. So it was surreal to be there. I have to be honest. Would have been really easy to get very nervous, but I felt like that whole weekend he was with me. He was looking down on me, and he was helping me out through the entire process. So I can't take credit for anything other than you know, collaborating with my brother and doing the right thing that needed to be done. And, you know, and now he's there. So that's the most important thing.
Yeah, it's good. And yeah, I mean, when I watched the whole video, you did not look nervous at all. It was a great speech. So you did a good job.
Well, I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. That was a wonderful weekend.
That's good. Yeah. I hope to visit that facility and check it out too. Yeah, so, all right, let me ask you one last question. I guess if your grandfather was still alive and he was able to see the how American tennis is currently, do you think that he would be happy with how it is current right now? Or would he want something different?
Yeah, I mean, I think he'd be a little puzzled beyond the careers that Serena and Venus have had, and that's been phenomenal. I think he would have been tickled pink about the success they've had. I think what would shock him, though, is the amount of time that was between Althea's win at the U.S. Open, and you can even look at, you know, her wins, you know, 57 and 58 at the U.S. Open in Wimbledon. He'd be shocked by the length of time it took. With all the progress he made in the 50s, the early to late 50s, he would be floored by the fact that it took another, I don't know, 30 plus 40 years before the next African American woman won a major title. I think he'd be floored by that, and I think he would also be floored by the fact that we've not had anyone follow in Arthur's footsteps. And when I say follow, I mean it's a pretty high standard. So we were always about winning national championships and winning titles. So, you know, there's certainly been a number of great African American players since Arthur, but none of them have reached the mountaintop, if you will, in terms of winning a major men's final. And so I think he would probably say there's more work to be done. And, you know, he'd obviously believe that it can still be done, but still more work to be done, so.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
No problem. All right, cool. Hey, Landry, we're reaching towards the end of the show. Do you have any final thoughts or words you'd like to say before we end today?
Well, you know, I just want to thank you for the opportunity and the platform and say that the work that you're doing is really, you know, an essential ingredient to keeping the light burning and delivering on that vision. I mean, the goal is to reach as many, diverse communities as we can and get the sport, get them involved in the sport. And I think once you do that, things happen pretty organically. But if you don't expose people to the opportunity, you can't really make it happen. So we've got to reach as many folks as we can, and the work that you do and the USDA does from a diversity standpoint is critical to making that happen. Critical.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Angela, thank you for coming to the show, and I look forward to in the future I can work with you some more. It was great listening to your feedback on about your grandfather, and I think we learned a lot today. So thank you. Thank you for that.
Appreciate it, Alex. My pleasure. Yeah. I enjoyed it.
Okay. All right, cool. Have a good afternoon, all right?
You too. Take care.
Yeah. Take care. All right, guys. Everyone, as that concludes our show, thanks to everyone that tuned in. I will be hosting my next show on next Saturday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. My guest will be Mark Ito. He is a current USTA League captain for a Washington, D.C. 4.0 men's team. To stay connected to all of the UR Tennis Network radio shows, be sure to subscribe to our channel at blogtalkradio.com/UR Tennis Network. And you can also like the fan page at facebook.com/UR Tennis. Thanks again, everyone, for tuning into the Minorities in Tennis show. Have a very good weekend. Bye-bye.